From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business of Sports from Bloomberg Radio.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jason Kelly.
And I'm Mike Lynch.
And I'm Michael Barr. And this is the Bloomberg Business of Sports podcast, where we explore the big money issues in the world of sports.
Guys, this was probably one where we should have told our producer, Tim Hare, to just hit record earlier, because we just went down a bunch of rabbit holes before we actually started recording. Tons to talk about. And I want to get to the valuations that Forbes put out today about the teams. We were just going down all sorts of rabbit holes and doing math and geeking out, and we'll do that a little bit later on. But first, we got to talk about the Kentucky Derby, Churchill Downs, Bob Baffert, and the winner of the Kentucky Derby, Mike Lynch, tested positive for drugs. This is a really big, really disturbing, and yet altogether not that surprising story, right?
No, Bob Baffert's a little bit radioactive in the horse racing world. He has been in trouble at a lot of different states and racetracks around the country. But his horse, Medina Spirit, the post-race drug test failed. And Bob Baffert has been banned from Churchill Downs. Now, think about this. This is like Tiger Woods being banned from Augusta National, like Bill Belichick being banned from ever competing in a Super Bowl again. That's how big this is. And this hasn't happened. A Kentucky Derby winner hasn't been DQ'd for failing a drug test since Peter Fuller's dancer's image back in 1968.
All right, gambler among us, Mr. Michael Barr. How do you read this? I mean, first of all, we should get out of the way. One failed drug test, the horse has to be tested again. Baffert denies that they in any way used this anti-inflammatory drug that he and his team did. He's sort of crying foul that, you know, some either there's a mistake or somebody has done him and his team wrong. I did read a comment, which I can't take credit for, that said because of Bob Baffert and all of his denials over the past year alone, this is like your dog eating a semester's worth of homework in terms of the excuses that he's making. But what do you make of this from the perspective of someone who follows this game from the window, as we say, this industry?
Well, let me point out the steroid is beta-methasone.
Yeah,
and it's used sometimes to treat pain and inflammation in horses, which is a banned steroid. Now, having said that, I hate to say this, these stories happen often at the local tracks, and they kind of slip under the radar. But this, you're talking the horse race of the year, and you're talking the Hall of Fame trainer, and this comes out? It's OMG. I couldn't believe it. And by the way, and we were talking about this earlier, if you made a bet, and even if you're on the online betting site and you bet Medina Spirit, you get the money. They can't take it back. It's over and done with. And let's also keep this in perspective. They haven't DQ'd the horse yet. So let's make sure to say that. But my goodness, this is huge. And if that happens where they DQ Medina Spirit, and by the way, the horse is set to run in the Preakness this Saturday. I don't know what happens.
And so, Lynchy, we talked about this a little bit, I believe, leading up to the Derby, that horse racing knows it has a problem. And in the midst of the pandemic, there was a lot going on, obviously, because of a global pandemic and eyes were elsewhere. There has been some legislation passed that is trying to lock this down a little bit more to clean up the sport. It obviously hasn't happened yet. But, I mean, this is one of the comparisons that I also saw in reading about this over the weekend is there's a Lance Armstrong sort of echo here in some ways with the denials. And I'm looking at the Sports Illustrated headline and subhead says Bob Baffert's leaking credibility reaches saturation point after Derby drug positive. When it comes to drug testing in sports, the denials are always vigorous, often fanciful, but are rarely compelling. This is bad for the sport.
It is, and it happens in the sport's biggest event. This is like something happening in the Daytona 500 or the Super Bowl or the Masters tournament. Baffert is a slippery guy, as everybody knows. He had a problem in Arkansas last year. And this year had a record betting. Only 2019 had more interest, betting interest in the Kentucky Derby than this year as well. So a lot of people came back, and a lot of people who want to stay away from this sport because they think it's a little bit shady are going to be a little bit disappointed again. It's bad public relations for the sport. You know, you can just say, well, there's one bad apple, Baffert. There's a lot of bad apples in that sport, and image polishing is job one for them, and this doesn't help.
Well, and I do think it is hard to overstate the prominence of Baffert and his horses in this sport in many ways. This is not someone who is in any way, Michael Barr, on the fringes. I mean, he is one of the most decorated when it comes to big-time horse racing. And so that starts to influence the perception, that ultimately starts to influence the economics of this business. You know, we had a great conversation, I thought, leading up to the Derby with the CEO of Churchill Downs. We know how much money is on the line, not just from the gate, as it were, but from the online betting that they have stood up there with Twin Spires. That is a driving force of this. But people are not going to participate. And again, I turn to you as our gambling expert here. If people think it is fixed in any way, or there's cheating, I should say, in any way, I mean, I would imagine at some point people start to step back, or am I wrong there?
No, you're not wrong at all. I got a Twitter comment that was really negative about horse racing. And of course I said, well, of course you're entitled to your opinion. And I get it. I get why people feel that way. Now, when you dope, if it happened, if you dope a horse, well, no, it has happened because Baffert said, yeah, the horse tested positive for this. Now it's like, according to Churchill Downs, failure to comply with the rules and the medication protocols, it jeopardizes the safety of the horses and the jockeys, the sport's integrity, and the Derby's reputation. And as a bettor, now it turns into, it's like, okay, now I got to get Benny on the back in the stall to see if he's got any info on this. And nobody's going to do that. A lot of people just go to the track. They'll study the racing book, and it's like, okay, this is the program, and this is where we're going to go, and let's see what the times are. But, you know, this is crazy. And in the biggest sport, I guess that's where I'm, like, freaking out.
Yeah.
Hey, Chase, let me ask this, though. Is this an indictment on horse racing itself, or should it strictly be on Bob Baffert? Because this is the fifth time a horse that he has trained has failed a drug test.
Well, you got to remember, too, it's not only just Baffert. Remember the Santa Anita affair where people, the horses were just, you know, breaking down and they had to put the horse down. And it's, this is a mess. And you're right, Lynchy. It's a combination of both. But especially with Baffert, it's like, come on, man. You're the man. You're the trainer. You're in the Hall of Fame, and you could be out of the Hall of Fame if this is true. So I don't know what to say.
I mean, I go back to the Lance Armstrong comparison in part because I do think that one of the ways that this has been allowed to go on is under the guise of everybody does it, which was certainly, I think, a lot of the defense. If you read some of the terrific books and articles and watch some of the documentaries that have been done about Lance Armstrong, he is very much of the belief that everybody was doing it, and that if you wanted to be competitive, you had to cut some corners and you had to do certain things. And so I don't think, I mean, based on, and I do not know as much as you do, Michael Barr, about this, and probably less than you do as well, Lynchy, but it doesn't feel like this is just a bad apple situation. It feels like there is something broken with the sport, as there was clearly in cycling in many ways, that, you know, this was something that either people got away with for some amount of time. And I will tell you, if cycling is any indication, it crushes the economics of a sport when people find out that there is widespread cheating. Now, listen, there is cheating that has gone on and probably continues to go on in other major sports as well. You know, baseball certainly had its moment dealing with its own steroid crisis and yet was sort of able to get through. We'll talk about the existential crisis in baseball another time. But, you know, to me, this looks really bad. And I think comes at a time when this is not something that the sport needs. Now, again, we should point out there's another test to go. It's a split sample, as they say. So they're going to do a second test on the same sample that they got from the horse. And we'll see, you know, whether the suspension holds up, whether the horse is disqualified. You know, I think, barring something very strange happening, probably aren't going to see a Triple Crown winner this year. And if we were to see a Triple Crown winner, I think people would like rush to write the biggest permanent marker asterisk on this that we've ever seen. So we'll see what happens. But it is not something certainly to be taken lightly. And I think in this grand return that we've been talking about, and we did talk about with the CEO of Churchill Downs couple weeks ago, this was not how they wanted the Derby to go off in any form or fashion.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum, powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
All right, let's talk valuations, can we? Because I just went down, we talked about this. I went down so many rabbit holes.
You can't resist, can you? Huh?
I can't. I really can't. And what was funny is, I give a shout out to an email newsletter that I read just about every morning. Kendall Baker writes it for Axios Sports. And, you know, there are a number of different valuations that come out around sports teams. Forbes is one of the ones that we all look at. Sportico, our friends over there, do a nice one as well. But, you know, this is one, Lynchy, where I do think there are some surprises as you go through the top 10. The number one, without any further ado, the Dallas Cowboys, who, you know, they're the most valuable sports team in the world, single sports team. The NFL haven't won a Super Bowl in quite some time, but Jerry Jones, man, he's got something that is very, very appealing and very, very valuable. What do you make of that?
Well, it's not surprising. When they were tagged America's team in the 70s with Staubach and them, it just sort of became a moniker that they never shook. And a lot of people in different parts of the country are Dallas Cowboy fans. They buy their jerseys, they buy their merchandise, they make an annual trip down there. He's got this stadium that can seat 110,000 people. He's got a great local TV contract, and he was one of the first guys that broke away. The NFL had a deal with Coca-Cola, and he was the renegade. He made a deal with Pepsi-Cola that I think tripled his profit on soda sales. This was back maybe 15 years ago, right after he bought the club. So I'm not surprised that they're number one. You know, the Yankees, you would say they are probably the most profitable baseball team. But then we get into some other ones, which are kind of surprising. The first NBA, the Knicks are on there at number three.
Yeah.
But number six, the Golden State Warriors, valued more than the Los Angeles Lakers, the New England Patriots, the New York Football Giants. That shocked me.
Yeah, that was the one that I think stood out to all of us. So by the numbers, the Golden State Warriors, the value, according to Forbes, $4.7 billion. Now, here's something that is really amazing, and this just shows you what a juggernaut this franchise is. So the current ownership group bought this team in 2010. They paid, wait for it, $450 million. That's 10x, guys. That's 10 times your investment for Joe Lacob and Peter Gruber and the rest of the gang. And we were digging into it a little bit, Michael Bardet, to try and figure out what it is. Obviously, Steph Curry Draymond Green, you know, the Splash Brothers, all of that. Winning championships certainly helps. That new arena in downtown San Francisco, apparently that's a big difference, putting them ahead of the Lakers.
Oh, yeah. And if it comes down to the players bumping the value of the team, and if I'm a player and everybody's like, oh, these guys get all this money. Yeah, because of this.
Yeah.
And if I'm bringing in a lot of money for a sports team and I'm up there, it's like, you're doggone right, I want to get paid. One thing that surprised me about this, I thought the Los Angeles Dodgers were going to be higher, but they're number 16.
Mm-hmm.
They're valued at $3.57 billion. And I thought then at the time, remember when Guggenheim Baseball Management, yep, when they purchased the team back in 2012 for $2 billion, I'm like, oh, guys.
It's that,
like,
seemed crazy.
It seemed crazy. And now they're almost approaching knocking on two times their investment. So it shows you how much money is involved in these teams.
One more bit on the Warriors, and then I have a question for you, Lynchy. So the Warriors, they have the biggest five-year change in value in the top 10 by a long shot, 147%. That is the five-year change in value. And as we said, in terms of the overall valuation since the club was purchased by Lacob and Friends, is 10x. So your New England Patriots are there. Yes. The Boston Red Sox round out the top 20. I do think it's important to point out that there's only one ownership group that we can see that actually has two teams in the top 20, and it is Lynchy.
Yeah, Liverpool and the Red Sox, Fenway Sports,
yeah,
Group.
Exactly. So, yes. I mean, an interest, especially because we've been talking about Liverpool in a different context over the past few weeks with the European Super League and all of its woes, and who knows whether what happens next on that, and we could talk about that a little bit more in a minute. But, you know, here you have two incredibly valuable, fast-growing franchises, certainly Liverpool. You know, what's interesting is the football teams, the soccer teams, I should say, for our American audience, who are in the top 10 are not English football teams. You have Munich, Bayern Munich in there, and you have Barcelona. I think those are the – and Real Madrid, excuse me. So those are all three of them in the top 10. Liverpool is just outside the top 10, and then the Red Sox there in the top 20. So that is a very, very – that probably is the most valuable sports group, at least according to this list, in terms of across there. And those Boston sports can't sleep on it. They got two right there in the top 20, although, you know, New York probably
that's a little bit richer.
I'm just saying. It's fine.
That's what we do. We just hang banners around here. We don't have
Man.
Conference championships. We just hang world championship banners.
There you go. Yes. There you go. Any other surprises for you on this, Lynchy?
No, I think that, you know, that the people that really haven't paid much attention to European football,
yeah,
are having their eyes open, first with this failed Super League, what has been happening now with this list, and saying, wow, this is really something that, you know, we pay attention once every 4 years in the World Cup. Basically, the majority of viewers around here are for sport. That's their on their menu, pretty much. So the other one that sort of surprised me a little bit was the Rams, but I think it's only because they've only had a year or so in that stadium. They haven't, yeah, had a full year with fans. They're gonna vault up a little bit. And Kroenke owns Arsenal, I think, over
That's
in
right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this is gonna change over the next year or so.
Yeah, absolutely. That stadium is certainly going to continue to contribute there, SoFi Stadium, which as of right now is scheduled to host the next Super Bowl as well. I did want to do a beat, if we could, on college sports before we wrap up this conversation. A big interview with Mark Emmerich in the New York Times over the weekend, talking about name, image, and likeness. This is something we've talked about on the show quite a few times. A lot of states, including my home state of Georgia, have recently pushed through this notion that players should be paid by companies who want to use their name, image, and likeness to promote their products. And here we go. The NCAA finally saying, yeah, we probably should go ahead and do something about this. We actually are going to vote. You know, Lynchy, I know you have some opinions about this in terms of, you decide, and I'll let you say it for yourself, but sort of on the side of the there's a lot of value in a college education, which I think nobody would argue with, but it feels like this train is leaving the station to some extent on the name, image, and likeness side as well.
Right. Well, I'm going to lose on this because it's going to happen. The NCAA would like to have it happen by July 1st. I talked to my sister last night. Her daughter just got admitted to Boston College. And the room, board, and tuition, thank you, $80,000 per year.
Wow.
So that's $320,000 education. So soapbox that I stand on say it's a mutually beneficial relationship. The school gives exposure to an athlete that otherwise wouldn't have it if they were not playing for that particular school. The athlete's stature rises through all the appearances on television. If Trevor Lawrence didn't go to Clemson, would he be the number one draft choice in the National Football League right now if he played like pickup football? No. He did because he went to Clemson. And so now he gets a contract that's worth $36 million a year. I know it's coming. If it's coming, I want the money put into a trust so it can't be spent while they're in school and they draw on the trust when they leave college. That's as far as I'm going with this one.
So a couple things to say. I mean, Michael Barr, it is important to point out that, this is not the colleges at this point in time, and this could change down the road. This is not the colleges paying players directly. We have effectively sort of nationally tabled that, at least for the time being, although there is a Supreme Court case that could throw that into question as well that has been argued before the court, and the court is meant to rule probably in the June timeframe. That's more related to colleges and their and the NCAA and its antitrust exemption and what that may mean for colleges paying directly. The one thing that I would say, and I take your point, Lynchy, on the Trevor Lawrence example, one fascinating thing that really came to the fore as I was researching this for a recent documentary is that the beneficiaries of this particular name, image, and likeness legislation, whether it's through the NCAA or through the individual states, interestingly, may end up not being, even though the Trevor Lawrences and the Zion Williamsons in the world will, almost certainly benefit from this. It will be interesting to see whether teams and individual players on, say, the UConn women's basketball team, whether it is Olympic caliber athletes who are in college, get to benefit from this. Stars who might not otherwise get that big NFL payday or that big NBA payday, that this will be the pinnacle of their athletic achievement. And, you're often talking about just using the UConn women's basketball team as an example, these are the most famous athletes in Connecticut for a time. And, and my argument would be they deserve to be compensated for that in some form or fashion. So I take your argument, Lynchy, about, wanting to be safe and sound with your money. But I think that the tide has shifted and probably rightly on this. And I do think, most importantly, the NCAA, thank God they actually are going to act on this, because I do think, Barr, it would be a hell of a mess if you just left it up to the states, and then you're going to have a lot of different elements here. So the NCAA needs to get off its collective butt and really make something happen.
And let's add, the laws we're talking about the states, Florida, Alabama, Georgia, Mississippi, and New Mexico, those are the states right now that are pushing for this. And it's funny, I'm listening to this discussion, I'm listening to Lynchy's argument, and you know my argument as a degenerate gambler: get paid, ladies and gentlemen, as much as you can legally. But we come to one point of a compromise that we agree on, Lynchy, and that is I could go with put the money in a trust, and then when you graduate, there's that money for you. Because don't give a college athlete a wad of cash, because we know what's going to happen for a lot of these people if they do it, and it's going to be spent. So that's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that the one other argument that I've heard around this that I'm sure I've said on this show before and I've said in many private conversations is I do think that it is reasonable to expect that an athlete should be able to benefit from his or her own accomplishments in the same way that another college student who also may be on a scholarship of some sort and may be getting the benefit of a reduced price or a free education at one of these schools if he or she writes a book or invents an app mm-hmm. or, you know, makes some sort of medical discovery that is ultimately commercialized, there's no restriction on them getting paid. So we'll see where this turns out, but certainly a big step forward with the NCAA, which had effectively tabled this, and I think the pressure was really growing. You know, some of the reaction that I got over the weekend just as I was tweeting about it was largely around, so what happens with Congress here? Because in the U.S. Congress, Chris Murphy, a senator from Connecticut, maybe not surprisingly, given everything we've just been talking about related to Connecticut, right. He is very much in favor of this legislation. I spoke with him for this documentary that I worked on around this. So there is some federal legislation that is making its way through. Obviously, the Congress is dealing with things like COVID relief and infrastructure and all sorts of things. So we may see that this summer. So there do need to be some rules here.
One quick story. I do remember when I was in college, I worked at a football camp run by one of our assistant coaches, and I drove about 45 minutes every morning, spent 8 hours there, and I was not allowed to get paid because I was an NCAA athlete. A friend of mine was in the school band, you know, played at halftime. In the summertime, he could play, he played the saxophone and could play with his gig, and they were making money at all these jazz clubs and restaurants and pubs. And, you know, he'd come back at the end of the summer and have like $2,000 in his pocket. And I had to go spray mosquitoes for the town of Swampscott to make the $2.35 an hour. I couldn't make any money teaching anybody how to throw a spiral.
Or kick a winning field goal, right? I mean, it's like, come on. You're not telling me, Lynchy, that you wouldn't have showed up at a local car dealership. You'd be like, Lynchy, the hero of Harvard, kicking through the uprights and get a deal on a new Mercedes-Benz.
All I know is I know you had to do some handyman work for that football you put through that lady's window, man.
That's right.
Right through there. This is the Bloomberg Business of Sports podcast. I'm Michael Barr on Twitter at Big Barr Sports.
And I'm Lynchy. I know when I'm beat, I'm waving the white flag on this name, image, and likeness, but I have to get my 2 cents in. You can find me at LynchyWCVB.
And I'm Jason Kelly. Find me on Twitter at Jason Kelly News. We're here each and every Monday, Wednesday, and Thursday, exploring the world of money and sports. And speaking of those Golden State Warriors, check us out at the end of the week. We're going to check in with Brandon Schneider. He is the CFO of the Warriors, so he's going to tell us all about how to build one of the world's most valuable sports franchises.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business of Sports on Bloomberg Radio, around the world and online, wherever you get your podcasts.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum, powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.